We come now to Isaiah chapters 7 to 12, and these chapters are all concerned with the Judean king Ahaz. And Ahaz was probably the worst king that Judah had had up until this time. The chapters are largely concerned with one major crisis during the reign of Ahaz. And to understand this, we'll have to have a look at this map behind me here. Up until this time, the major power in the region had been Syria. If you go back to the stories of Elijah and Elisha and Jehu, the major power then was Syria. But Syria had since declined, and it was now no more than a third-rate power, comparable in status and size and power with Israel and Judah. So we have these three small nations. The capital of Syria is Damascus, and the king of Syria is a man called Rezin. The capital of Israel is Samaria, and the king of Israel is a man called Pekah, the son of Remaliah. The capital of Judah is Jerusalem, and the king of Judah is Ahaz. Now those are the three nations, the three cities, and the three kings that we have to keep in mind as we read this section through. The rising power in the whole of that part of the world was Assyria, which is shown purple on the map. Assyria was expanding its power across towards Syria, Israel, and Judah. So Syria and Israel, between them, got the idea that if they could put these three small countries together in some sort of alliance, they would be able to withstand the spreading power of Assyria. The king of Syria, who was Rezin, and the king of Israel, who was Pekah, came to Ahaz, the king of Judah, and put the proposition that these three countries form this alliance. God's message to Ahaz was this: don't form an alliance with these unbelieving people. You trust in God, and God will save you from the spreading threat of Assyria. But when Ahaz refused the offer from these other two smaller countries, they decided that they would then attack Judah, conquer Judah, get rid of Ahaz, put their own puppet king on the throne, and then in this way they could ensure that the three small countries formed their alliance. Then they would have a chance of withstanding the larger threat from Assyria. Now, if you want an up-to-date parallel politically with this, you have it in the events in Southeast Asia, where you have Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, three small countries, and the big threat is China, as far as they're concerned. Vietnam already gets Laos under its control. Vietnam and Laos then want to get Cambodia into it, and Cambodia won't cooperate. How do you solve the problem? You then invade Cambodia and put your own puppet ruler on the throne, and this way you get the three countries into the alliance, and so hopefully they can withstand the threat from China. Now that's the sort of parallel to what we have here in the story of the threat from Assyria. Well, things get more complicated, because when Syria and Israel attack Judah, Judah panics. Ahaz, the king, panics. Now remember that what they're doing is they're trying to get Judah under their control so that they can withstand Assyria, because they're all frightened of Assyria. What Judah does when Judah is attacked by these other two countries, this is the irony of the whole thing, Judah then decides it will go to Assyria and ask Assyria to come and help it to withstand these other two nations. Now Isaiah comes on the scene and he says, don't do it. You don't make an alliance with these two to withstand Assyria. You don't make an alliance with Assyria to withstand these other two. You trust in God. And if you trust in God, you will be delivered from the invasions. But if you don't trust in God and you make these alliances, the alliances won't save you. And you'll find that the nation whose help you have asked for eventually will dominate you. Now that really is the message of these chapters. Now let's look at what's happening here in chapter 7. You'll find if you read 2 Kings chapter 16 that the details are all given there. But we won't go back into 2 Kings, we'll stick to Isaiah chapter 7. And this outlines what I have just said to you. In the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but they couldn't conquer it. When the house of David is of course the ruling dynasty, of which Ahaz was the king, When the house of David was told Syria is in league with Ephraim, Ephraim, remember, is just another name for the northern kingdom Israel, his heart and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. He trembled. His knees were knocking, as we would say. Verse 3, the Lord said to Isaiah, go forth to meet Ahaz, you and Shear-Jashub your son. Remember that name, Shear-Jashub, we'll come back to it later on. And meet him, he says, at the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field, and say to him in verse 4, take heed, be quiet, do not fear, don't panic, in other words. Don't let your heart be faint because of these two smouldering stumps of firebrands. That's all they are. They're burnt out, these characters. You don't have anything to fear from them. After all, they are only Rezin and the son of Remaliah, who is Pekah. Verse 5, because Syria, with Ephraim, that is Israel, and the son of Remaliah, Pekah, the king of Israel, has devised evil against you, saying, verse 6, let us go up against Judah and terrify it. Let us conquer it for ourselves and set up the son of Tabeel as king in the midst of it. You see, there's the plan, to conquer Judah and to put their own puppet king on the throne there in Judah. What does the Lord say in verse 7? God says, it shall not stand, it shall not come to pass. Don't fear, it won't happen. Because after all, in verse 8, what is the head of Syria? It's only Damascus. And Damascus is just an ordinary old town. It's not the great, glorious stronghold it once was. And who is the king in Damascus? Well, none other than Rezin. And you don't have to fear him. And in verse 9, what is the capital of Ephraim? Is it not Samaria? Who'd be frightened of Samaria? And who's the king in Samaria? Only Pekah, the son of Remaliah, an assassin who took the throne for himself because he didn't like the person who was on there before. You don't have anything to fear from Syria and Israel. You don't have anything to fear from Damascus and Samaria. You don't have anything to fear from Rezin and Pekah. Trust in me and you'll be delivered. But the alternative is at the end of verse 9. If you will not believe, if you do forsake the way of faith and put your trust in military might, then you won't be established. Nothing will save you. So that's the message. God is then very gracious to Ahaz, and he says in verse 10, ask a sign of the Lord your God. It doesn't matter if it is as deep as Sheol or as high as the heaven. It's open field. You can ask any sign you like to confirm to you that what I have just said is true. But Ahaz, in verse 12, with a sort of mock piety, said, I will not ask and I will not put the Lord to the test. Far be it from me to do such a thing, says Ahaz, as he tries to ape a more pious person. Well, then says Isaiah in response in verse 13, you won't ask for one, you won't ask for a sign, well, God will give you one nevertheless. So listen to this, O house of David. Is it too little for you to weary men? Must you weary my God also? There's a sense of humour coming through here. You're a dead boar as far as other people are concerned, and now you're trying to bore God. Look, verse 14, the Lord himself will give you a sign, whether you ask for it or whether you don't. A young woman shall conceive and bear a son, and she'll call his name Emmanuel, which means, of course, God with us. This child is going to eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. That means when he's, let us say, 2 or 3 years of age. He's going to eat curds and honey, which are the products of a land where agricultural activity has ceased and people are just surviving on what they can get from the stray cows as the wild food in the bush. But the point is in verse 16. Before the child knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, so let us assume that that is a reference to before the child is 2 or 3 years of age, the land before whose two kings you are in dread will be deserted. I'm giving you this sign. A lady will give birth to a child. She'll call its name God with us. It will show you that God is with you, and that before this child is 2 or 3 years old, the tide will so have turned that you can be confident that God will give you the victory. And you need not fear these two kings and their invading armies. God is going to be with you, and Judah will be delivered from the threat. And all this is going to happen inside the next 2 or 3 years. But once again, the alternative, if you don't believe, it won't come true. Verse 17, the Lord will bring upon you and upon your people and upon your father's house such days as have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, the king of Assyria. If you trust me, God will be with you. if you don't trust me, God will bring upon you this invasion from Assyria. Now this is a reference to the fact, which you'll find referred to in 2 Kings, that Ahaz went to Assyria and asked Assyria to come and help him withstand the invasion from Syria and Israel. Isaiah says, if you do that, all you're doing is delivering yourself into the power of Assyria, and what's going to come upon you is going to be great devastation, such as the nation has not known since the days when the northern and southern kingdoms separated. It goes on to develop this in verses 18 to 20, which we won't read. There are various pictures there of how Assyria will come in and destroy the land. Verse 20, very descriptive, the Lord will shave with a razor, which is hired beyond the river, that is with the king of Assyria. He will shave the head, the hair, the feet, and even the beard, just like some hairy person gets the razor treatment. Take the lot, every hair in your body, the hair, the beard, the lot, that's what's going to happen to your country, stripped bare as this nation Assyria comes in and conquers. That's what will happen if you don't believe. If you do believe, God will deliver you because he'll be with you. In verse 21, you have a development of what we read in verses 15 and 16, that in that day a man will keep alive a young cow and two sheep. That's all that's left, because the rest of them have either died or the farmlands have been trodden underfoot, agricultural activity has ceased. In verse 22, because of the abundance of milk which they give, he will eat curds and honey. Everyone that is left in the land will eat curds and honey, because that's all you'll be able to find, just the wild food or the milk from the cows or the goats or whatever you can find wandering around the countryside. That the standard crops of the farmer will exist no longer, because the place is going to be trampled underfoot by the invading armies. Now that is the sign and the message which God gave to Ahaz the king. Trust in God and you'll be delivered. Trust in military might and you'll be decimated. Ahaz did not believe. You come now to chapter 8 and we find the same proposition put now to the people. Just as the sign had been given to Ahaz, now we have a sign given to the people. The same message, trust in God, is preached to them as was preached to Ahaz. So in chapter 8 verse 1, the Lord said to me, that is to Isaiah, take a large tablet. I like that one. He must have had a heavy cold. Very odd the things you read sometimes, isn't it? Take a large tablet and write upon it in common characters, belonging to Mahershalal Hashbaz. And if you look at the margins of your Bible, you'll find that it has something to do with the spoil speeds, the prey hastes, or as is well put in the Good News Bible, quick loot, fast plunder. Write that on a board. So in verse 2, I got reliable witnesses, whom he mentions, and in verse 3, I went to the prophetess, who appears to be his wife, I certainly hope so, in view of what we're going to read, and she conceived and bore a son. And the Lord said to me, call his name Mahershalal Hashbaz, and you must feel some sympathy for the son. For, in verse 4, before the child knows how to cry, my father or my mother, that is, before the child can say mummy or daddy, the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria. You get the picture? It's the same one, virtually, as was given to Ahaz. Before the child was 2 or 3 years old, said the Lord to Ahaz, the enemy will be gone. This is a little later on, at least 9 months later on, by the time the child is born, so that the age of the child is now down to, let us say, between 1 and 2 years. And before the child is 1 or 2 years old and can say mummy and daddy and get a few elementary words, before that time, once again, Samaria and Damascus, the two nations which have invaded you, will be conquered and the spoil will be carried away by the king of Assyria. You trust in God and you'll be delivered. That's the message. But the people did not trust in God. As Ahaz wanted military might rather than faith, so the people wanted military might rather than faith. It's the same test that we are being put to today. It's very easy to forsake the way of trust in God, and that does require patience, but it's easy to forsake that way and to opt for something which we can measure, something which looks stronger, more tangible, and so faith goes out the door. We think we're getting success, but in the long run, it's rather the opposite. And that's what the prophet speaks about in verse 5. The Lord spoke to me again. Because this people have refused the waters of Shiloah that flowed gently. Shiloah was the name of a canal that ran across Jerusalem. There was no natural water supply in Jerusalem. They had to rely on wells and springs and then channel it through different places across the hill. This is a reference to God, quiet faith in God there on Mount Zion. This little stream, you refuse that little stream. It's not impressive enough just trusting in God, trusting in Zion, trusting in the waters of Shiloh. You would rather trust in something massive like the Euphrates River, which is, of course, Assyria. He says, because these people refuse the way of faith, they refuse the waters of Shiloh that flow gently, and they melt in fear before Rezin and Pekah. Therefore, verse 7, behold, the Lord is bringing up against them the waters of the river Euphrates, mighty and many, the king of Assyria in all his glory. It will rise over all its channels, it will go over all its banks, it will flood, it will sweep on in verse 8, and it will overflow into Judah, reaching up to the neck, and its outspread wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. The land where God said, I will be with you and deliver you. If you don't trust in me, you won't get deliverance. Rather, you'll get swept away in a flood. As the masses of Assyrian forces sweep like a flood across the country, ravaging the place and leaving it desolate. He goes on in the next couple of verses, we'll skip over verses 9 and 10 to verse 11, where the Lord spoke to Isaiah with this strong hand upon me and warned me not to walk in the way of this people. That is, don't opt for the way of sight rather than faith. Verse 12, do not call conspiracy all that this people call conspiracy. That is, don't join in all the schemes and the alliances that these people want to join in. That is, the alliance with Israel and Judah against Assyria, or the alliance with Assyria against Israel and Judah. Don't do that sort of thing. And also, he says in verse 12, do not fear what they fear. The people of Judah were fearing these invasions of Israel, Syria, and the like. Rather, verse 13, the Lord of hosts, let him be the one you regard as holy. Let him be your fear. Let him be your dread. Put your faith in God, not in military alliances. Verse 14, he will become a sanctuary and a stone of offense. God will be to you either the source of your salvation or the source of your destruction. If you trust in him, the source of your salvation, he'll be a sanctuary. If you don't trust in him, but trust rather in the military might of some other power, then you'll find that God will be to you an opponent, a rock of stumbling to both houses of Israel, that is, the north and the south, a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and many shall stumble thereon and fall and be broken. We find that the people did not believe Isaiah. Ahaz, the king, had not believed, and the people likewise did not believe. We find then that what Isaiah does in verse 16 is to concentrate his efforts upon the faithful few, that is, the remnant, as we have come to call them. Now this again is the theme that I've touched on very lightly in the opening chapters, and you'll find it coming through all the way, right through the whole book of Isaiah. The people as a whole were going to reject God, but the remnant would believe. What Isaiah has to do is to concentrate on preserving the remnant. The bulk of the people have got their eyes set on destruction. They are determined to follow their own way, and they're going to bring the nation to ruin. Isaiah, therefore, is going to concentrate on the faithful few and build them up, because God is going to preserve the faithful all the way through. Eventually, the nation will go into captivity. We'll find that later on. And after the captivity, God will bring them back. And the faithful remnant will perpetuate itself from generation to generation, so that when they do come back, there will be the faithful there who can reconstruct the nation on a proper religious basis. Therefore, in verse 16, Isaiah says this, bind up the testimony, seal the teaching among my disciples. That is, I am not going to have open preaching to all these people indefinitely. I'll concentrate on my disciples, and I'll teach them the word so that they will be able to serve God. I will wait for the Lord who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob, and I will hope in him. Expression of faith. Verse 18, behold, I and the children whom the Lord has given me are signs and portents in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells on Mount Zion. Now, who were the two children that the Lord had given Isaiah? The first one was Shear Jashub, and the second one was Mahershalal Hashbaz. These two, he says, are signs. Shear Jashub, meaning the remnant shall return. If you look at the margins of your Bibles there, you'll find that in chapter 7, verse 3, the meaning there, a remnant shall return. That's one sign. Although the nation is determined to destroy itself, a remnant shall be preserved, and the remnant shall return to reconstruct the nation. That's one sign. The second sign is Mahashal al-Hashbaz, which means quick loot, fast plunder. Originally, it meant, don't fear Israel and Syria, because they will very quickly be invaded by Assyria, and they will provide loot and plunder for the people of Assyria. But he says, now this is going to be a sign also to the people of Judah, because if you trust in Assyria, very soon you'll find that you become loot and plunder for Assyria, and you're the ones that will be getting your possessions taken away. All right, that summarizes those two chapters. Now, as we get to the end of the chapter, chapter 8, we find that there wasn't much light at all. If I can just fill you in on some of the historical details around this time. If you went back to the book of Kings, you'll find that very soon after these events, the events that I'm talking about here occurred in 735 BC. In 732 BC, Syria was destroyed by Assyria. And that was the end of the nation of Syria as it existed in Old Testament times. Assyria then spilt over into Israel, the northern kingdom, and parts of the northern kingdom were conquered, and some of the people taken into captivity. Various puppet kings reigned in the northern kingdom for the next 8 or 9, 10 years, but eventually in 722 BC, the whole of the northern kingdom was destroyed. And Samaria was left in ruins, and the people were taken off captive by the Assyrian conquerors. So that was the end of Syria, and that was the end of Israel. All that is left now is the nation Judah. And Judah is heading for the same disaster as Israel had met. So the whole picture is one of gloom. Gloom in the north, with the conquest by Assyria. Gloom in the south, with Ahaz leading his country towards destruction. Now that's referred to in the last couple of verses of chapter 8, verse 21. Still referring to Ahaz and the southern kingdom. They will pass through the land, greatly distressed and hungry. When they are hungry, they will be enraged. They'll curse the king, they'll curse God, and they'll turn their faces upward, and they'll look to the earth, and behold, nothing but distress, darkness, gloom, anguish, and they'll be thrust into thick darkness. And that's not very optimistic, is it? Now, when you look at the northern kingdom in chapter 9, the opening verse, the second sentence says, in the former time he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. Zebulun and Naphtali were northern tribes around the Sea of Galilee area in the former kingdom of Israel. But in the latter time, he will make glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations, again the northern kingdom. What's happening is this. The northern kingdom has already entered a period of darkness. The southern kingdom is also entering a period of darkness. But out of this total picture of gloom and despair, God is going to bring light. You're familiar with these verses because they occur in the Gospels where they apply to Jesus Christ. And as we read on, then we find that the hope for Israel, Judah, is the hope of the Messiah coming. So in verse 2 then, the people who are in this darkness will see a great light. Those who dwell in the land of deep darkness, on them has light shined. Out of all this gloom, a conqueror is going to come. A new era of light, joy and peace is going to come. And this was the messianic hope which the people of Israel always held to. And so it goes on in verse 3, talking about the great joy and the rejoicing that there will be when this era of light dawns. In verse 4, the yoke of the burden is to be taken away, the staff of the oppressor is to be broken, the rod with which they were beaten is to exist no more. In verse 5, the enemies who invaded them are to be removed, and all the bloodshed and the horror of war is to be put behind them. And in verse 6, light will dawn, peace will come, the Messiah will appear. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. The government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end, and upon the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. Now we can see things, I think, fairly clearly when we look at the New Testament we find references going back to this period which are applied to Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is, of course, the Prince of Peace. The Messianic age dawns with him. Life and light come through him. The gloom is removed. We walk in light. The burdens are taken away. And I think we're very familiar with the sorts of pictures that apply to the salvation which comes through Jesus. Now, he becomes the true Emmanuel. Back in Isaiah 7:14, we had a reference to Emmanuel being born of this young woman. I'm sure that you're all aware that the Hebrew word translated virgin or young woman is capable of broad range of meaning. And the context is going to determine whether it simply means a young woman of marriageable age or a virgin in the technical sense. And the same applies to the Greek of the New Testament, where you can think sometimes of the word applied to young women, the story of the 10 virgins, 5 wise and 5 foolish, or sometimes specifically to a virgin in the physiological sense, as in the case of the Virgin Mary. This is part of the beauty of the scriptures, that things that were originally written in one context are now taken and given a higher meaning in a new context. In the time of Ahaz, we had this woman who would give birth to this child, and she would call it God with us, because obviously God was with them in helping them win the battle. When you come to the New Testament, Matthew takes those words, but he gives the other meaning to the same Hebrew word, and he applies the word virgin in its strict, literal, technical sense, that this one, Jesus Christ, is to be conceived of a virgin. And he is going to be God with us. Now, people in the Old Testament times, lots of them gave their children names because God was with them, or God was helping them, or God was their rock, God was their fortress. But in the case of Jesus Christ in the New Testament, God with us is not simply God is going to look after us and be friendly to us and help us win our battles. God is literally going to be with us in that the Word will become flesh and dwell among us. And the virgin who conceives is indeed unique. I believe the virgin birth, or the virgin conception of Jesus Christ, is unique. He was the only one. Back in the time of Ahaz, we had this other reference, of course, to the young lady there, but that was a prefiguring of what would happen, of course, when Jesus came. And through him we have deliverance. God actually is with us in the form of this one who was born of a virgin. And so, the sign now comes again in verse 7 to the house of David. Remember, back in chapter 7, the sign was given to the house of David to Ahaz the king. Ahaz was representative of the house of David. But now we find that the true Emmanuel, God with us, Jesus Christ, is the eternal God. He actually dwells with men, and he is the Messiah. He is the great descendant of the house of David. He is the offspring of David. And upon him, in verse 7, all the glories of the house of David descend. And so he is the chosen Messiah. It's a magnificent section. And what we have to do is not to suddenly leap out of Isaiah chapter 7 because we see a well-known verse there and misconstrue its meaning, but rather see it in its original context, interpret it for what it is and what it must have meant to Ahaz. But then as we move on, we find it taking on fuller meaning here in chapter 9. And as we come to the New Testament, we have the full-blown thing as the Messiah himself now comes and God dwells among men. That really completes that section. And from verse 8 through to chapter 10, verse 4, you have a section slotted in which again talks about the social and religious reasons for the destruction which has just taken place in Israel. Because the same things happened in Israel as were happening in Judah. And what the prophet is saying here is this: you people ought to learn the lesson. The people of Israel had all these social injustices and God destroyed them. Now you have the same things in your society and God is going to destroy you also. So chapter 9 verse 8 through to chapter 10 verse 4 is a repetition of the sorts of things we saw in our opening study. But as you see in verse 9 there, the things that are spoken here reflect the situation as it was in the northern kingdom, Israel. It came to destruction. Likewise will the southern kingdom come to destruction because it is characterized by the same evils. Assyria is God's rod of anger to chastise his people. Chapter 10 verse 5 through to the end of chapter 10 deals with Assyria. I'm not going to look at this section, but what it's all about is this. God used Assyria to punish Israel. God is now using Assyria to punish Judah. The trouble is, Assyria becomes arrogant, and it thinks that it has achieved all this conquest because of its own greatness. So, says God, I will punish you, Assyria. because you are arrogant and you don't submit to my sovereignty. That then is the general drift of verse 5 through to the end of the chapter. We'll just read a few verses from verse 5 onwards and you'll see that that's the general run of the section. Ah, Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff of my fury. Against a godless nation I send him, that is against Israel, against Judah, and against the people of my wrath I command him to take spoil and seize plunder. Another reference back there to Mahashal al-Hashbaz. Verse 7, but he, Assyria, does not so intend. You see, he doesn't understand my purposes, and his mind does not so think. It is in his mind, rather, to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. He sees this as an opportunity for his own expansionist policies and to simply make himself stronger. He boasts in verse 8, are not all my commanders as kings? Did not in verse 9 I conquer this town and some other place? In verse 10, as my hand has reached to the kingdom of the idols, whose graven images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria, shall I not do to Jerusalem and her idols as I have done to Samaria and her images? What he's saying is, all the different nations round about, their gods and their idols have not been able to deliver them from me. Samaria was not able to deliver itself from me. The gods of Samaria couldn't save Israel, and the gods of Jerusalem won't save Judah. He boasts against the Lord, and so in the remainder of the chapter, from verse 12 through to the end, God, when he has finished all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, when he has punished Jerusalem for its sins, he will punish the arrogant boasting of the king of Assyria and his haughty pride. And so it goes on then from verse 12 right through, outlining how God is going to do it. Having got rid of that, we come now to chapter 11, where we pick up the theme of the coming Messiah. Remember the last verse of chapter 6, where we saw that God was going to preserve a remnant. The holy seed is its stump. We now find that that remnant is identified with the dynasty of David. And out of the dynasty of David, God is going to bring the Messiah, Jesus Christ, who was, of course, the son of David. So now we're tying together all those threads that we saw in the first 6 chapters and now in the second 6 chapters concerning the promised seed, the preserved remnant, and out of it, the faithful who will reconstruct the nation, and then out of that, the Messiah himself, who will be the Savior of the world. And that's the way God's purposes are working. Verse 1 of chapter 11, there shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse. That refers back to chapter 6, verse 13. And a branch shall grow out of his roots. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. Here you have now the characteristics of the Messiah, the one that was spoken of in chapter 9. The Prince of Peace, the Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father. Here he is now. The Spirit is given to him in unlimited measure. He not only has knowledge, but he has wisdom, the ability to apply that knowledge correctly. He delights in the fear of the Lord. Second half of verse 3, he is not partial in judgment. And this is a reference back to the partiality that we saw in the opening chapters, where there was bribery and corruption and they acquitted the guilty for a bribe and they trod on the innocent. The Messiah is not like that. He is the perfect judge. He does not judge by what his eyes see or decide by what his ears hear. But in verse 4, with righteousness he will judge the poor. He decides with equity for the meek of the earth. And so it goes on. Verse 5, righteousness shall be the girdle of his waist, and faithfulness the girdle of his loins. A picture now of the characteristics of this Prince of Peace. It then goes on from verse 6 to the end to talk about the characteristics of the Messiah's kingdom. A kingdom of peace, and again you can think of the New Testament references to the peace which Jesus Christ has brought. It's pictured here in the well-known illustrations in verse 6 of the wolf and the lamb lying down together. In verse 7, the cow and the bear feeding together. In verse 8, children are not even frightened of snakes. And so the curse of Eden is reversed. In verse 9, men no longer hurt and destroy each other because the knowledge of God now fills the earth. And when the knowledge of God does have its effect, the result is that people don't do these evils to each other. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. In the end, they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the peacemakers. In the end, they are the ones who will inherit the Messiah's kingdom. It goes on in verse 10 through to verse 14 to give a picture of how the people are going to return from Babylon after the captivity that I have spoken of. You're going to find in due course that Assyria will be conquered by Babylon, and then Babylon in turn will destroy Judah and cart off the people into captivity. But after they've been there several generations, they will return. And here in verse 10 to the end, you have a reference to the return of the Jews from captivity following the Babylonian conquest. Now that is a theme that will be dealt with at length in the final section of the book, from chapter 40 through to chapter 66. So I'll just touch on it very briefly here. Verses 10 to 14 picture the people returning from many nations. They're mentioned there in verse 11. And in verse 13 we find that the old jealousy between the northern and the southern kingdoms is now removed, and there's going to be peace and harmony. Verse 14 and 15 talk about how Israel and Judah are going to get square with the enemies that previously had plundered them. And then in verse 15 and 16, their return to the land is likened to a second exodus. Just as once they had come out of captivity in Egypt in the time of Moses, so again they will come out of captivity from Babylon back into their land. And the last part of verse 16 tells us that as there was for Israel when they came up from the land of Egypt, so now there will be this highway from the lands into which they have been taken as captives. Chapter 12 then gives us the song which these returned exiles sing. If you go back to the time of the deliverance from Egypt under Moses, you find that after they had been saved out of Egypt, there was the song of redemption which the redeemed slaves sang. Now in chapter 11, they are saved from the lands in which they are held captive. And in chapter 12, you get once again the song which the redeemed sing. Verse 1, you will say in that day, I will give thanks to thee, O Lord, for thou wast angry with me, but thy anger turned away, and thou didst comfort me. They're forgiven now, the anger is gone, the punishment is over, and they are restored. This forgiveness and salvation leads the people to confidence. In verse 2, I will trust and not be afraid. It leads to strength. In the second part of verse 2, the Lord is my strength and my song. The Lord has become my salvation. It leads in verse 3 to joy when he draws water from the wells of salvation, joy and refreshment. And so here you can see the people now celebrating their great victory. Now we are the redeemed of God. Although these verses originally applied to the people of Israel in Old Testament times when they came out of their captivity, surely we as the people of God today can read them with a deeper meaning, you might say, or apply the meanings to ourselves and make the words our own, as we realize that God has redeemed us from slavery. He's brought us into the promised land. He's given us the inheritance. We become his people. And so we too can draw water from the wells of salvation. We too can say God is our refuge, our strength. We are trusting in him. We have confidence in him. And verse 4 to the end shows how we can show our gratitude for this great salvation. Oh, give thanks to the Lord and call upon his name. Make known his deeds among the nations. Proclaim that his name is exalted. That is one way that we can show our gratitude for the redemption God has given us. We can declare to others what God has done for us. Make known his deeds among the nations. In verse 5, we can praise him. We can sing praises to the Lord because he has done gloriously. Let this be known in all the earth. We can take his message, the message of his salvation, to the ends of the earth. And in verse 6, we can shout and sing for joy, O inhabitants of Zion, for great in your midst is the Holy One of Israel.